Soon three females arrived with plaid blanket. I guessed one female was old because her fur looked thin and she limped. They all wore newer, clean blankets. They stood and looked at us, and we looked back. I wanted to sit down but didn't dare. Plaid blanket launched into some kind of explanation, pointing at us and Roland a lot. The whistles and cacks meant nothing to me. But Marie interrupted. She squawked. Cheek! Everyone stared at her, including the glassmakers outside peeking in through the open doors. Plaid blanket repeated what it had said. Marie squawked the same sound. Then she tried to describe with gestures and a few sounds the fact that we came from Rainbow City. At least, that's what it meant to me. Then she used her canteen to ask for something to drink. One of the younger females said something in return. Plaid blanket talked more. Then they yelled at each other. Finally, the young one seemed to get angry, and they all left. Guards stayed at the doors.
"You talk glass maid, Marie?"
Kung said on the ground, far away from Roland's body. Marie looked for a place to sit. I had already sat down on a mat, almost fell, really. I was so tired, and moved over for her.
"I listened while we marched and learned a few words. I said attention or listen, I think. Something like that."
10 workers came to take away Roland, still wrapped in his blanket.
"Shouldn't we stop them?" Cedar said.
"What would we do with him?"
Marie said. The glassmakers lined up, 4 on each side of the body, 1 at the head and feet, seemed to count to 3, heaved him up, and left. Marie repeated the count quietly. Buzz, croak, gurgle. She looked the words up in her dictionary.
"I think the writing is phonetic. I hope so. That would be a big breakthrough."
"Ask for food," Cedar said.
"I asked for water. When they bring that, we can all ask for food."
She tried to smile, but she was too tired. She nodded off soon. I think I slept too. After a long time, I thought I smelled meat cooking. Maybe mountain bear. I couldn't tell. Stinking glassmakers. But they'd brought us water.
Maybe a feast after a funeral, Kung said.
An execution, Cedar said.
The cat dozed on her lap.
These are violent people.
I'm dying of hunger, I said. Marie had woken up.
Try to survive.
She took a comb from under her backpack and fussed with her hair.
We don't want to offend them. Unnecessarily, at least. They have odd habits and probably odder rules.
They're violent and primitive, Cedar complained.
Yes, they are. It's worrisome.
There have to be real glassmakers somewhere, I said. This must be a subgroup. They got lost from the main group or something. Marie nodded.
Maybe. These are very disappointing. But they are glassmakers, and we have our job.
We looked out the door, but all we could see was guards and the wall of the next tent.
Funerals, Marie said. That will be a test.
From the look on her face, she was going to pass the test, no matter what.
These glassmakers, look at their shoulders, Kung said. They move up and down, not sideways, not like this.
He motioned to throw.
2 elbows. Their arms aren't strong. Can they dig to bury him? Or do we dig,
A couple of glassmakers walked past the tent carrying firewood.
I've read, Marie said, that some earth cultures burned their dead. We're here to make friends. They don't seem to have much experience at that, so we will have to provide the example. Music. A few words. You can say something if you're moved, of course. I will. Our goodbyes, our memories, our friendship. Set an example.
Can we cry? Cedar asked, challenging Marie again.
Please do.
When Lux set, a group of workers marching in time came to get us, carrying spears and led by Plaid Blanket and a drumming major, and I grabbed my backpack with the flutes. They took us to the edge of the village where everyone had gathered, and five females stood in the front of the crowd. The stink almost overcame the scent of cooking meat. I had looked into the doorways of huts as we walked past. The biggest thing I saw were looms for making blankets. No furniture or much else except a few pathetic boxes and baskets. Two mats waited for us, one almost new and the other one heaped with green leaves.
Sit,
Marie said, pointing, and we arranged ourselves on the bare mat. I thought about which flute to play and what song. The unmoving glassmaker faces surrounded us. Someone began drumming, and the sound came from the direction where the food was being cooked. I picked out the flute with the lowest register and played a sad song by old Uncle Higgins that had words about living a day too long and seeing failures you couldn't prevent. Perfect. Marie began humming along. On the second time through, Cedar and Kung joined us.
Once more,
Marie whispered. I did, with more feeling. I had never liked Roland, and I would miss him for exactly that reason. I set down the flute. A female with curls of dark fur down her back, the one that had argued earlier, repeated the opening bars of the song in a hoarse whistle, almost a squawk. I played the first seven notes again, then held another flute out. She stepped forward and took it. I held mine up to my lips. She copied the gesture, though her mouth was vertical. I blew and made a note. Fa. She blew and made a breathy note. She did it again. I covered the first hole and blew to make a different note. Mi. She copied me. One by one we copied the notes, then, together, a duet. We played the seven opening notes in order. Fa, mi, do, mi, re, do, re. Finally, I had played a duet with a glassmaker. I lowered my flute and bowed solemnly. But I didn't feel solemn. I wanted to jump and shout. I had shared music. If we could do that, we could do anything. They were willing. They just didn't know how, like Marie said. And we would have to provide the example. We had a lot to teach them, more than they could imagine. The glassmaker stared at me with those big, blank eyes. She handed the flute back. But we would play again, I felt sure. These glassmakers weren't all bad. If this was a funeral, it was time to bury Roland. But we didn't know where he was. We didn't have shovels. We needed a place to dig. The smell of cooked meat came on a wind, and I was so hungry I couldn't think about anything for more than a moment. A drum started beating again in the direction of the cooking area. People made way for something large. Clouds of steam rose from it. A roast, a very large animal, maybe a Fipalion. I had never smelled anything quite like that. But it was delicious. I glimpsed it again through the crowd. Maybe it was a small lion.
Bear, Kung murmured.
I got a better look. Not a bear. It was a large animal with a round head and a flat torso like no animal I knew, and the skin was grilled crisp and golden and shining with fat. The crowd opened up, and I got a clear look. Not a lion. Not with such long legs. Cedar wailed, hid her face in her hands, and turned away. The head lay face down, and I recognized a crisp and golden ear. A human ear. my mouth filled with saliva, not from hunger, but from the rush before vomiting. I got to my feet and ran, hand over my mouth, away from the crowd, and dropped to my knees. Marie had said again and again to set an example. I had to, somehow. Glassmakers were watching me. I tore off a chunk of moss from the dirt to make a hole and puked into it. There was nothing in my stomach but bile, bitter yellow slime, spasm after spasm. Every time I thought I was through, a whiff made my muscles jerk again. Finally, the bile burned my nose and destroyed my sense of smell. I waited, panting. I was done. Empty, completely empty. I put the moss back over the slime and used my tears to wash my face with my sleeve. The salt on my lips cleared my mouth a bit. I stood up. The glassmakers squeaked and whistled. Cedar had her head in her hands. I stumbled toward Roland. Maybe this didn't mean what I thought it did. No, I knew what a roast looked like. This was supposed to be food. Kung stared at the ground. Marie stood up and stared at plaid blanket, and tears dripped down her face. I had never seen her cry before. Never. The female who played music came to stand beside plaid blanket. Arms spread, she said something to us and waited for our response. Behind her, glassmakers jabbered at each other. She said it again, and I looked at Marie. She sighed.
"Thank you very much,"
she said gently, although her face said something else. She faced the glassmakers.
"Numbers are a measure, and we are less now. We came in peace,"
she continued.
"We will remain in peace, regardless. My job now is to praise Roland. He was what a FIP master should be, enticing and gentle and always, always confident, a lion among men. He was what a member of this mission should be, ready to give everything to create a good first meeting between our people. He gave everything. I am going to assume,"
she said in a strong voice, although she was still crying,
"that you mean well. In fact, I am sure you have behaved respectfully. We can't accept your kindness, but we thank you for it. Roland will not rest in peace, I think. I will not for the remainder of my days, whatever their number. I can only hope that we will achieve something from our many misunderstandings. I am sure we have mystified you. We will continue to do so."
She turned toward us.
"Nye? Kung? Cedar? Anything to add?"
Cedar stood up and blew Roland a kiss.
"On behalf of the women of Pax,"
she said, and shuddered and turned away. Kung stood stiffly.
"He was kind to his animals, always kind."
I stood up, felt dizzy, and spoke anyway. "He wasn't a friend. He was usually really annoying, but he was a good FIP master, and he tried to be friendly, and I'll miss him. I really will." Marie took a spoon that had come with Roland and approached the friendly female. She pantomimed digging, made some glassmaker noises, and tried to show that she needed something like a spoon but big.
"We're going to bury him,"
she said.
"It would go easier for all of us if you get us tools and selected a spot."
After a lot of confusion and cacking, a female slapped a major. There was more yelling, so loud my ears hurt, and some arm waving and a few more slaps. I looked at Marie.
"I told them I'd mystify them."
But she didn't say it as a joke. A worker finally ran toward us carrying a crab-shell spade.
"Where?"
said Marie again and again, pointing to different places, and after even more arguing, Plaid Blanket pointed to the edge of the area where we were, but he didn't seem happy.
"You start,"
she told Kung, and pantomimed drinking and squawked,
"Cheek!"
And they all jumped, and a worker brought us water in bark buckets. It tasted sweet, so sweet, and I washed away the bile from my mouth and throat, and I knew right away it wouldn't come up. Something that Marie had said had changed my feelings, but I didn't know what it was. I cupped my hand and held out some water for the cat. It drank. Then it went to help Kung dig. Very soon, I relieved him. I had to dig. I had to dig, or I would start smacking glassmakers in their immobile, big-eyed faces. They didn't need to be so horrible. They didn't need to cook Roland. The spade chopped into the damp soil. The glassmakers kept yelling at each other. If they were afraid of us, they would have treated us better. They should have fed us. They should have talked to us. They should have come with us to Rainbow City. They should have had a beautiful city of their own. They shouldn't have burned Steveland. They should have sung, not squawked, and their squawks were making my head hurt. They should have cats and clothes, and they should be understandable. They shouldn't hit each other. And Cedar called my name and pointed. Six majors were punching and kicking each other, and then two females tried to break it up, and they started yelling and swinging their fists at each other, too. Marie was watching in a way that I knew meant she was learning something. I started digging again. Glassmakers weren't at all like what I had come for. They were stinking, stupid savages. And Roland, what they did to Roland was horrible. I kept thinking the same things over and over again. I was panting hard. The cat had stopped to chew on a root. The glassmakers were still yelling, but not fighting. Marie tapped me on the shoulder.
"Cedar will dig for a while. She needs to do something," she said quietly.
"What if they don't let us go?"
"Think of the mission."
Her voice didn't sound like she believed her own words. "I am. We were supposed to make friends, but I don't want to."
"I understand. I'm not sure I want them as friends either, but we need to be at peace with them."
Marie herself finished digging the hole and lifted out the cat. We each picked up a corner of the mat where Roland lay and slid him in. He broke apart as he fell. Marie was fast in sprinkling dirt over him, and the cat joined in, kicking dirt into the hole with its big back feet. I went to my pack and got the silver bead seeds I was going to take back to try to find a girlfriend, and I sprinkled them over Roland. We shoveled more dirt, and then it was done. The cat was hopping on the mound to flatten it. Marie turned toward the glassmakers. The people who were fighting had separated into two groups. They started shouting louder than ever at each other and at us, waving hands, a few holding sticks. I looked around to see where to run if they attacked, but they could outrun us. I picked up my backpack as a shield.
"Cheek!"
Marie shouted. They began to quiet down.
"Cheek!"
she said again. She gave them the look that could light a fire.
"Thank you for not interfering. I am sure you are confused. We are more confused and disappointed than I could tell you if we spoke the same language. This is unlikely to change soon, and I am very troubled about that."
She ordered me to play music again. I didn't feel like it, but I did anyway, repeating Uncle Higgins's song, this time letting my feelings fill the notes. It sounded like the glassmakers, exactly like them, harsh and unmusical. "We should never have come." That's the song I was playing, living a day too many in the wrong place and seeing things I never wanted to know. They didn't stop arguing even while I was playing. A couple of workers brought us food. Marie thanked them elaborately, although there wasn't much food. 4 little flat loaves of nut bread, a dish of stew with onions and gritty snowflake bugs, and a basket with some velvet leaves and tomatoes. We gave the leaves to the cat. I was still hungry.
"Will they let us go?" Cedar said. "If we don't go back soon, we'll never make it over the mountains in winter." "I hope so," Marie said. "Our job was to meet them and express our hope of friendship."
"We did that," I said.
"Yes, we did," Marie said.
She looked worried, maybe even afraid. As soon as the food was gone, they took us to a small tent. The ground was covered with onion leaves.
"Perfume," Kung said. "For them."
He shook his head. The tent walls kept out all fresh air. I was too tired to sleep, but I lay down in the onion leaves and fell asleep right away. When I opened my eyes, Kung was using the chamber pot. The air smelled worse than ever. Marie squirmed her hand through the tent flap until she could reach a peg and open it. The sun was rising. The guards outside said something.
"We need fresh air," she said.
I wouldn't have argued with her.
"Noisy at night," Kung said. "Noisy now."
There were lots of cacks and cheeks and squeaks. They were apparently still arguing. Cedar looked out the door.
"Rain for sure. We're going to get a steady rain."
The cat was eating the onion leaves. I was thirsty. Marie demanded, water, even said a squeak that she thought meant water. I smelled wood smoke and roasting nuts. I was hungry again.
"We ought to go and warn the city," Cedar said. "The glassmakers are dangerous."
Marie didn't answer. They didn't seem to be in a hurry to talk to us. The cat made a game out of harassing the guards. At noon, 3 females and Plaid Blanket came with a squad of workers carrying spears.
"We're in trouble," Cedar said.
But Marie left the tent and greeted them as if they had come to make some sort of formal visit. I tried to imitate her self-confidence and stared at them, those stinking idiots.
"Look at everything," Marie said. "Learn what you can. Nye, count heads."
A female, the one who had played the flute, announced something. The glassmakers became silent. They gestured for us to fall into a procession, drums ahead of us, drums behind us, all of them too loud. The cat in my arm tried to squirm away, and I held it tighter and covered its ears. I started counting as we were marched through the ugly little village. 5 females, about 40 majors, about 60 workers, maybe 15 children, but they ran around a lot and were hard to count. Maybe 120 altogether, 120 disappointments. The procession turned toward the path out of town back toward the mountains. We had to scurry to keep up. They finally stopped at the edge of the forest and pointed on ahead.
Yes,
they were sending us home. But we had nothing. We couldn't walk that far with nothing. They were sending us to die. Marie cleared her throat. Hooves sounded behind us from the village, and workers arrived with our packs and handed them to us. They gave Kung our canteens filled with water and gave Marie a battered basket filled with loaves of bread.
"We must give gifts in return," she said.
"The cat," Kung said. "They want the cat."
Marie nodded. I handed it over, soft and warm. I wondered if they would learn from the poor animal or if they would cook it. "One more thing," I said. I took a flute from my pack and held it toward the female who had played before. Plaid Blanket grabbed it. Then she grabbed it from him and yelled, waving it like a club. I suddenly hoped they choked to death trying to play it, if they ever did. Marie faced them, impassive.
We have enjoyed your hospitality and sincerely look forward to meeting you again. I am sure our peoples have much we can teach each other, and eventually we will have a long and peaceful and productive relationship. It has been a genuine privilege to be part of this mission and to meet glassmakers face to face. I can speak for all of us in saying we will never forget this.
I wondered how much of that she believed. I didn't believe a word. The female whistled something in return, then she turned her back, then another female turned away, although Plaid Blanket kept watching us. We took the hint and began walking. Far, far away through the trees, mountains rose like red walls, and the skies looked gray and ugly. After about 2 hours it began to drizzle and the path got steeper, and in another hour we found an overhanging rock to protect us. Cedar said a hard rain would start soon. I dug a trench to protect us from water pouring downhill. The women gathered firewood. Kung tore down some tree branches to make a lean-to and block the cold wind. We huddled around a fire and ate some bread.
"We did our job," Kung said.
"What? We failed completely," Cedar said, and began to list everything that had gone wrong. "Because of Marie," she began at one point.
"Marie did fine," I interrupted. "I never liked her, but this was the job for her." Marie was right there, but I couldn't stand to listen to Cedar whine anymore. "It's true," I said. "A lot of things went wrong, and I hate these glassmakers." Kung grunted. I kept talking. "But I don't think we could have done anything different. We tried to make friends. We tried hard. What more do you want?"
Everyone was silent. Marie looked at me and, after a while, nodded. The rain started falling hard.
"I wanted them to be what I expected," I said. "That's what went wrong. They weren't what I wanted at all. They weren't the glassmakers I grew up with."
"We learned a lot," Marie said. "They're nomads. That's a temporary camp. They got rid of us because we'd slow them down, and they're not hanging on by much. And then we went and wasted all that meat. We aren't compatible. Not at this point."
"But we didn't communicate," Cedar whined.
"We did. They saw us. They saw that we're strange, but we're not going to hurt them."
"All that way to say that, and they might hurt us."
"They liked the music," Marie said. "The music was a success."
"I hated playing for them," I said. On an impulse, and one I'll never regret, I reached into my pack and took out my flutes and burned them. No one stopped me. A mistake. That's what this trip was. My mistake for wanting to come. One mistake, easy to make, and it cost so much. I would never play the flute again. I never wanted to see another glassmaker ever. If I had children, I wouldn't let them play with glassmaker dolls. We had a long way to go, and the trip would be hard and cold and miserable. The worst thing would be arriving at the city, because we would have to tell everyone what had happened and what the glassmakers were really like.
Lucille and Steveland. Year 107, Generation 7. The name of this planet and commonwealth shall be Pax, as a reminder to ourselves for all time of our aspirations. From the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pax. Lucille. Damn. Cedar walked into the gift center right after I did. Lucille, she muttered, without even a hello or a smile. What lizard was in her liver now? Nice weather tonight, I said. The words echoed around the gift center dome, and I ducked into a stall and pulled the straw curtain shut. I sat there, bare butt on a cold ceramic seat. Nice weather if you like it chilly, She and I were liking each other less every day. Well, nobody likes to lose. I won the co-moderator election a week ago, and she didn't. I decided that if I moved quick, I could get out while she was still in her stall, but I heard her curtain open while I was still buttoning my pants. The spring had been dry, which meant poor groundwater flows, which meant the center smelled like poop. But still, I could wait and she'd leave. Then I could go back to Tatiana's funeral and wonder what to do next. No such luck. "Did you notice what Stevelin said about Tatiana?" she said, and she had to be talking to me, because we were the only people there. "He said she argued with him and even got angry with him. Think about that," she said, and without waiting for me to think, she added, "She was tough with him. That's part of the job, keeping him responsible and reasonable." Translation: you better do the same, girl. I decided to re-retie the knot on my belt. It was an old belt, of course, old clothes for a funeral, and it didn't lie flat. I called back reasonably, "Pretty amazing about him dropping flowers into her grave." Translation: there was more between them than you think. I peeked through the curtain. Cedar stood in the light of an oil lamp, not leaving. "Damn." "You know," she said, "Stevelin thinks he should have found the glassmakers instead of us. Everything has to be his doing." Exactly. Stevelin had an ego like a mountain. It sort of made him lovable. The knot on my belt was as perfect as it could be. The laces on the faded old vest were tight. The knife underneath it didn't show. My socks were pulled up, and the darned patches were rubbing my heels. My collar would never lie straight, no matter what I did, and I was going to look like I was avoiding her if I stayed in the stall. So I smiled and walked out. "That's the problem with our defense," she said, standing by the crabshell water basin. "We have to have a defense, right?" She pointed a finger at me. "Answer if you dare." "Well, it can't hurt to be prepared," I dared to answer. Not everyone agreed, but there were all sorts of dangerous animals, so defense couldn't hurt even if the glassmakers weren't hostile. And who believed they were? Well, a few people did. I edged up to the basin to wash my hands. She barely let me by, and even though she was only 10 years older than me, she made it seem like more. "Our defense needs to be centered around what we can do," she said, "not what Stevelin can do for us." She still shook that finger, and her battered old funeral beads rattled. "He's part of it, of course. His outposts, his observations, his warning, that's going to be crucial. But what can he do during an actual attack? I don't think he understands offense. He thinks defense, 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 and that's not enough." "Well, we need to balance his ideas." He was all for that. "Balance, balance, balance." I decided my hands weren't dirty and rinsed them quick. The water was scented with orchids, but frigid. I'd be out of there in no time. We talked about defense at committee meetings lots of times. So why bring it up now? She leaned over the basin toward me. "We need a drill. A practice. Like a real attack." "Well, we can talk about that again." There would be a mountain of debate about that again. "Not just defending," she said. "Attacking. Like Higgins's battle." "Aren't there lions in the attack? Seriously." She never had a real sense of humor. Footsteps clopped on the wood walkway up to the gift center door. Someone was coming. Maybe someone who'd provide a distraction and I'd get away. "A full and complete drill," she said, "with an attack." Marie walked in. Cedar liked her even less than me. I tried to look serious. "It's on the agenda for the next committee meeting." Glassmakers were always on the agenda. "Good." She turned and saw Marie. "Yes, a drill of a counterattack against the glassmakers, just in case our next encounter isn't a diplomatic success." Marie was enough of a diplomat to ignore what needed to be ignored, I hoped. "What do you think, Marie?" Cedar said. She looked her straight in the eye. "I'll hope for success." Marie seemed a lot older than when she left on the mission. She'd lost weight on the hike home last fall. All four of them did, and she had bright green hair now, the color that comes from dye over pure white. She sighed. This was a tired debate. Cedar had argued all winter that we didn't really know anything about the glassmakers, except that they had weapons and abused each other a lot. So that meant they'd fight. And Marie had argued back that we had a more realistic picture of them, and obviously we'd need to protect ourselves, especially Steveland, but we didn't need to be aggressive, since aggressive plans would make aggressive acts easier to commit. Their only truce was the moment when Tatiana awarded eagle feathers to the mission members, including one for Roland. That one was on display in the museum. And here in the gift center, Cedar told Marie, "Kids don't play with glassmaker dolls as much anymore." Snottiness dripped from her voice. "That might be good," she answered softly. "We'll expect less."
"They're not our special friends anymore," Cedar said.
"It hurts to lose a friend." I said as happily and as helpfully as I could, "We'll try to make friends with them next time we meet." That had been my campaign slogan. Next time, friends. But the way Cedar snapped her head around to look at me, I realized I shouldn't have brought that up. "We need to do that," Marie sighed. "We all do. Almost all of us still want friendship." Translation: the friendship candidate, Lucille, won by a big majority, and you didn't. She tried to edge past Cedar.
"Then they should have voted for you," Cedar said.
Translation: Marie had also run for co-moderator and had gotten hardly any votes. That had been strange. She looked at Cedar for what seemed like a long time, sighed again and said, "I have kidney failure, interstitial nephritis. I might not be alive when we meet the glassmakers again, so I asked my supporters to vote for Lucille."
"What?"
I said. It was the most intelligent thing I could think of to say at the moment. "You were a fine alternative," Marie said, and entered a stall. Cedar looked at me without a hint of friendliness.
"A drill," she said, and left.
"You had them vote for me?" I called to Marie.
"You would have won anyway," she called back.
A deeply diplomatic response.
"Oh,"
I answered, another intelligent thing to say. I waited a minute to give Cedar a head start, then I headed back toward Tatiana's funeral reception. We'd known Tatiana was dying. We'd all seen her naked at the spring festival when she announced her retirement. She could hardly walk, even with two canes, skinny as a twig, except for the joints swollen up from an infection. Then she burned the moderator's chair, the real one, in the bonfire. That shocked everyone. And winning the co-moderator's election had shocked me because I had run only because I teach, taught, preschool, and I wanted to show them how elections work. "You need to think very far ahead," I told the kids. "You should vote for someone with experience and maturity." They nodded their little heads like they understood. And what did they go and do? Well, there were 15 little heads, and then on election night, we were in the meeting house, crowded butt to butt on the benches, watching the election committee pull fancy little papers one by one from the ballot box, read them out loud, and put them in piles. "Lucille? Lucille. Cedar. Lucille. Flora. Lucille. Lucille. Bartholomew. Lucille. Marie. Lucille. Lucille. Lucille." I'd voted for Marie. I got almost 200 votes. Now Tatiana wasn't there to give me advice anymore. Soft music and lots of talk would fill the meeting house if I went back there. Who'd voted for me because Marie said so? Daisy, probably. And Kung and Nye. Nye came back from the mission scarily changed. Quiet, serious, no more arguing, no more flutes. The new FIP master, Monty, who had he voted for? He was spending the evening with the cats and kids, helping them practice dancing, and he was so quiet and patient, you never knew what he thought. Hathor and Forrest, they were Cedar voters for sure. My parents? Who knew? 200 votes for me. I'd never figure it out. I tried to. On the night of the election, I helped Tatiana home and asked, why did they vote for me? She took several slow, painful steps. Octavo said a long time ago that pacifists were big hippocats. The perfect pacifist is happy and helpful. They're playful, gentle. That's you, Lucio. The biggest hippocat in the city. That's what people wish they were. They want a hippocat to represent us to the glassmakers. Well, thanks. Well, I mean, and young. You'll last a long time. Elections are disruptive, so people don't like them. Well, yeah. I was the first child in Generation 7, a lot older than anyone else in my generation, just old enough to be co-moderator. As soon as I'd hit puberty, properly chaste, I might add, since no one else was of my age, I decided that face paint would mark my generation, and I began painting up a storm, new colors and patterns every day. Will I have to quit teaching? You'll have too much to do to teach anymore, Tatiana said. We'd arrived at her house, and she patted my cheek with a dry, cold hand. Go back to the election party. Drink a lot of truffle. Your troubles start tomorrow. But that tomorrow had really arrived today, a week later, the day she died. Trouble now filled the meeting house. My tomorrows had just started, so instead of going back to the funeral reception, I decided to go to the greenhouse, and I kept the door open so Steve Lind and I wouldn't be talking in secret. I sat down and put my feet up on the table. Hey, that was nice, what you said at the funeral. After a moment, words flashed on his stem. Greetings, Lucille. It is customary to speak sincerely at funerals. He'd said, it is like a grove being taken from me. No one but she ever argued with me. No one but she ever became angry with me. It was a practice of equality that surpassed belief and ideation. We were not friends, she and I. I do not believe she liked me, but she never hesitated to try to teach me. I am a better pacifist because of her. Tatiana taught us all, I said then. Cedar wants to hold a drill in case glassmakers attack. Indeed. Tatiana taught me to aspire to mutualism with the glassmakers as a civilized course of action, rather than remain trapped in my fears and sadnesses, and I mean to continue to pursue civilization aggressively. Together we can balance, Cedar and I, as with you. You are optimistic, and you have good social skills, things which do not come naturally to me, and which will be important to build friendships with glassmakers and to overcome pacifist fears. Translation. I'd have to help him with Cedar, as if I could. Yep, I'm a big hippocat. Yes, humans and hippocats are social animals that avoid violent and aggressive behavior, and the glassmakers are obviously social as well. I believe this is why few people support Cedar. Humans aren't violent? That's what he thought. Tatiana had given me a steel knife and a heavy history lesson. Jersey wasn't Pax's first murderer. But that didn't make Cedar right. Did it? Who had Steve Lind voted for? Well, he had to know about Marie, since he helped with everyone's health. But he wanted to talk about missing far outpost groves again. Every time he didn't hear from one for a couple days, he panicked, even if the only problem was that the wind was blowing pollen the wrong way. Understandable, though. I was scared of slugs and crawfish. He was afraid of fire and lots of other things. Tatiana had said that he was unhappy, that he didn't even know how to be happy, and that she was no one to teach happiness. And now she was gone, leaving me. But hippocats were happy no matter what. I listened, and I said that friendly glassmakers wouldn't set fire to pacifists, and I hoped he felt better. I felt like too much depended on me. I said, water and sunshine, and went home. The next morning, I painted my face hippocat green and went to the meeting house to practice glassmaid sounds with Steve Lind and Marie. The sun was shining bright through the roof, splashing colors all around. Most of the debris from last night's reception had been cleaned up, and some of Harry's art still decorated the room. Marie and I sat down at the table. I wondered about asking about the election, but I'd have won anyway, right? I took a deep breath. Tatiana said I could imitate Glassmaid because I didn't mind making a fool of myself. Marie had learned some Glassmaid on the mission, and I was going to need to talk to the glassmakers sooner or later. Ah, cock-woo! I yelled. Then I laughed. I'd probably scared every bat in the city. How was that? Do the cock again, she said. I think you finally got it. Cock, 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 cock. That's it. How do you do that? I don't know. You close your throat and push with your diaphragm, Stevelin said. How do you know? I said. Understanding human speech meant understanding their vocalization techniques. I dedicated a route to that, as I must do now for vocalized Glassmaid. Roots? I want a Glassmaid route. I need to learn Glassmaid faster. We can't make friends if we can't talk. Correction. You want a Glassmaid voice. Vocalization is not a plant characteristic. Chromoplasts are a plant characteristic. And with the appropriate craft, you would not have to paint your face anymore. I can offer you a rainbow of colors. I thought a minute. Did you grow a humor root? You said I would find it enlightening. And you were correct. Oh. I'd told him a while back to lighten up and grow a humor root, but since he didn't have a humor root then, I guess he didn't know I meant it as a joke. I said, how about the ah, ah, ah? Does that come closer, or am I farting instead of pooping? I received no gift, Stevelin said. That humor root at work. Tense your vocal cords more, Marie said. Moderators, excuse me, Carl called to us from the door. Back so soon? Yes, there he was, and with a couple dozen people behind him. He was our top scout, supple as a cat and nervous as a bird, short and tan. He could walk for 40 hours without resting. He knew what was around the bend of a path, even if he'd never seen it before, and he could sneak up on an owl. He'd left that morning to go down the river valley all the way to the sea, a 3-week trip supposedly to prepare for a salt-making expedition, but we all knew that what he was looking for wasn't salt. Carl, I said, and then to be a playful fip, I said it like a cock. Carl, come in. Come in. Your report. Tell us all about the ocean. Still wet? Still big? How's the salt? It's great to see you back. Quick trip, too. Everybody, come in. He took off his hat and came in, sweaty, wearing heavy hiking boots and a camouflaged cape. The rest followed him, murmuring because they knew what he was going to say. Well, something about glassmakers, obviously. He sat down at the council table to give a formal report, his fingers drumming bird nervous on the tabletop. Cedar came dashing in and stood near the front. She already carried a bow and a quiver of arrows, so I knew what she expected. The mission hadn't seen any bows and arrows among the glassmakers, and when they got back, she had practiced until she could shoot an arrow accurately at 200 paces, and always went sleeveless to show off her arm muscles. "Glassmakers are here," Carl said. "Glassmakers?" I flashed a big cat-happy smile because I didn't know what else to do. The room got perfectly still, and so did I on the inside, but not a calm stillness. Couldn't let that show, though. He said, "They're in the valley downstream from the waterfall. I saw, oh, I'd say 100, carrying a lot of gear, about to come up the cliff. I ran back, but they moved fast. They'll be here any minute." Everybody looked at me, and I had to set the tone. 100? We'd been counting on a diplomatic mission, like maybe a half dozen, and we weren't even ready for that. But the tone, serious and calm. Fake calm would do. "Well," I began.
"Call everyone in," Cedar shouted.
"Well," I tried again, "that's..."
That's too many, she said, and they move too fast. If they aren't friendly, we have to be prepared. It's fine to be dedicated to peace, but now isn't the time to take chances. Steveland, Marie murmured. Fires, I have no roots east of the geological fault that creates the waterfall. I have no observations.
We get to meet them at last, Daisy rejoiced.
Not 100 of them, Hathor said. Not the way they smell. But we want to meet them, right? Nevada said. They made this city. They have a right to it. And if we're locked up inside, that wouldn't be friendly.
Marie nudged me. 100 would be the entire village, if they're the glassmakers we met.
Well, yes. Happy, helpful, playful. A lot of good that did right now, with everybody arguing. Marie should have been elected. Everyone was looking at me, expecting me to know what to do.
What do we do? I murmured to Marie. There's still time for a diplomatic mission, she murmured back. Ours. Bring people in as if it were an eagle attack, and then a few of us can meet them.
I concur, Steveland Stem said. I stood up. All right, here's the plan. Everyone inside, and then we'll send out a diplomatic mission.
Inside? Daisy wailed. But we want to meet them!
Cedar didn't hide her contempt. Another diplomatic mission? That's right, I said. And if it goes well, we all get to meet them. But 100 glassmakers, that's the whole village, isn't it? If it's the same glassmakers.
Cedar's eyes got big. Translation. She hadn't thought of that.
Now everyone inside. Hey, they stink and there's 100 of them, so we need to be careful. Got it?
A few people nodded.
Glassmakers are coming. Let's get ready. Cuck, cuck, cuck. I grinned like a happy fib.
What a lie. I felt like, well, I didn't know how I felt.
People started moving. We knew how to prepare for an eagle attack. Everyone inside is the first step. Trumpeters blew the call to return to the city. Farming teams began running home, and trained bats flew out on reconnaissance. I rounded up our diplomats. Steveland ordered the thistles around his groves to stand at attention. Crews hauled in firewood, boats, and everything valuable from storage sheds and workshops outside the city. Monty rushed to the lion pack, which grazed a few kilometers northeast, and we would communicate with him using smoke signals and bats trained to deliver messages in exchange for food.
Glassmakers were coming.
Friendly? Tolerable? Or a damn disappointment again? We'd been waiting since Sylvia's time for this. And legends, if you can believe legends about her anymore, said that she cried when she saw Rainbow City in ruins and realized she'd never meet one. Now we'd meet a whole village. I hoped they were nice just so I wouldn't have to deal with Cedar anymore. Most people waited up on the walls. We diplomats waited outside of the city at the river bluff. Marie, Kung, Bartholomew, Carl, a couple of other committee members, and I. Cedar was up on the wall somewhere.
The wall, almost 2 meters tall, it kept out nasty little things like slugs, but eagles could jump over it, and some kinds of deer crabs, and maybe the glassmakers could jump it too.
We'd repaired the wall and added some shelters for archers, but Cedar wanted more, and for once she was probably right. But we hadn't had time to do more. Outside at the bluff, I waited and looked down and around. Shiny gold tulips bloomed in the damp fields next to the river, and soon their leaves would sprout. Up on the bluffs on both sides of the river, beyond the roads, grain and cotton had germinated, and lentil trees spotted the landscape like purple polka dots. We grew the trees scattered so an attack of scorpions would get only one tree before we could stop them. Pale new leaves were everywhere on the trees and shrubs and snow vine hedges at the riverbank, and stands of rainbow bamboo stood here and there. It looked pretty, orderly, and promising. Would the glassmakers like it? Marie stood next to me, and tears shook on her lower eyelids. I'd have hugged her, but Kung had already wrapped an arm around her shoulder.
Nye was in the greenhouse to relay messages from Steveland because he didn't want to see any glassmakers at all. And who could blame him? He shouted, "The glassmakers are at the old outpost, farther upstream, at the ridge. I am getting little attention." Translation, "They aren't burning me." Nye's voice sounded relieved. I felt for the steel knife under my shirt because Tatiana had said it made her feel brave to wear it. But I didn't want to feel brave. I wanted to hop around like a cat with no worries at all. Behind us, teams pulled the gates shut and the big hinge posts grumbled in their greased sockets, and bars were dropped in place with a bang that vibrated through the stone and brick walls. I listened. "Glassmakers are noisy, right?" I asked Kung and Marie. They nodded. We couldn't hear anything. Finally, a bat flew overhead.
"Big animal coming."
Up on the wall, someone shouted,
"I see them."
A lot of people started shouting. Well, I couldn't see them from down on the ground.
"Where?"
I called.
"On the road, on the river bluff,"
someone answered.
"They're carrying something, a big box."
More shouting and waving up on the wall. I recognized Daisy's voice,
"Chico,"
which was sort of like the word we thought meant hello. I squinted at the road, and there were three or four glassmakers a half kilometer away, right where the road comes out between a couple of trees, and they weren't moving. The box was big enough to hold a Fippo lion.
"Scared," Kung grunted. "They see us. Big city. People shouting."
He began waving. I waved too and shouted, "Chico!" Friendly. Not scary. Not scared. They seemed to huddle. Everyone had committee meetings, apparently. Then they picked up the box, one at each corner, and started running toward us. They moved quick. Two jointed, skinny legs held far out from their body, just like the dolls I used to play with. Major casts. "Anyone we know?" I asked.
"Don't know," Kung said. "Let's wave."
"This is just a diplomatic mission, right? Just these four guys and a box. Nothing to it." The glassmakers stopped suddenly, set down the box, squawked something at us, and ran away, fast as lightning. Mission accomplished. Deliver the box. "There's writing on the box," Marie said. "I was hoping some of them could read." "Let's go read it," I said. Up on the walls, people were arguing over whether to open the gates. Cedar was screaming no. I decided to pretend I was deaf and kept walking, modeling calmness, for all the good it might do. Diplomacy depended a lot on lying. I'd already learned that from Marie. The gate stayed shut. When we were almost there, Marie said, "City friendship gift. It's for us. See?" The message had been painted on one side of the box in mud. The top was open. We got close and leaned over to look inside. 30 or 40 Fippo cats squirmed around inside and looked up at us. Latticework over the top kept them from hopping out, but one jumped up, grabbed a slat with its front paws, and hung on for a while. Carl shouted the news back to the city.
"Cats!"
"Why cats?" Marie said. I was going to say, "Because it's friendly," but I began to sneeze. Nye screamed from the city,
"It isn't a gift! Don't bring it in! Don't touch it!"
I backed away so I wouldn't sneeze on the cats and waved at Nye to show him I'd heard.
"Smells funny," Kung said.
"Lucille," Nye shouted, "come talk to Steveland!"
So I ran back to the city. They let down a ladder so I could climb up the wall, and then I climbed down on the other side and went to the greenhouse, ignoring all the people looking at me with big, doubting eyes. Nye sat inside with his head in his hands, staring gray-faced at Steveland's stem. Words were already waiting for me. "I suspect that the Fippo cats are being used in the same way that crabs infest a bluebird reef, with slug larvae to eliminate the birds," Steveland said. "I must be clear that I merely suspect. I do not know." They think the cats will eat us? I said.
You might eat the cats. Poison also can be absorbed through the skin, or inhaled, or the Fippo cats.